Maybe we'll just start with a quick prayer here. As a good Catholic event, right? In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. Dear Lord and Mother Mary, be with us during this evening, and guide our hearts and our minds tonight. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death, amen. Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. Thank you so much for all of you for coming. I'm thrilled for this evening tonight. I've been looking forward to it for some time. I'm very happy to say that we have representation here from St. Louis University, Washington University, Mercy, some people who have been coming to these events for a long time, and some who are first-timers. I also want to recognize that we have several students here, or residents, doctors in training here. So I want to recognize the young folks also. And while I have a chance and have the podium, I would like to just draw our attention to the website that we have up and running, which is right here, stlewiscma.org. So here's the homepage right here. And it is a great portal for you all for information about events coming up for the year. And that's about it for now in terms of announcements. So we're going to move towards our topic for the day, which is a journal club to talk about end-of-life issues, which is becoming more and more important. And I'm thrilled to have tonight with us two experienced and knowledgeable speakers on the topic. To start with, we have Sister Edith Mary. She is a professed member of the Religious Sisters of Mercy, whose mother house is in Alma, Michigan. She graduated from medical school from Oklahoma State University School of Osteopathic Medicine in 2006. She completed her residency in family medicine from Sparrow Hospital, Michigan State University in 2010, and then her fellowship in geriatrics from Michigan State University in 2011. She is currently in practice at Sacred Heart Mercy Healthcare Center in Jackson, Minnesota, and is the medical director at Good Samaritan Nursing Home in Jackson, Minnesota. She's an active member of the CMA and a current member of the POLST Committee of the National CMA and co-author of the White Paper, which was published last year, which is the CMA's position statement on POLST. So without further ado, I welcome Sister Edith Mary.
Well, thank you. What a pleasure it is for me to be here with all of you, and thank you all for coming. This is a really important topic, as many of you know. It's becoming more important as time goes on. POLST is an acronym, and it stands for Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. So I'm here to talk about what is the problem with POLST. There is a new reality in medicine. Those of you who trained much before 2000 knew a very different landscape, shall we say, in medicine. The doctor-patient relationship, I would posit to you, has eroded in some way from what it once was. Often primary care is being done in sometimes minute clinics, sometimes by several providers. It's used to be done by one physician kind of following your patients through various different phases, and now that's less common. It's also more common for patients to be cared for in hospitals by hospitalists and less so by their family physician. And in many respects, palliative care teams are much more common in the hospital systems and are taking over what's called the conversation, which is the end-of-life conversation. Now, many of these things have some very good aspects to them, but they also bring in a challenge for the family doctor or the primary care doctor. So one of my favorite movies might surprise you is Gladiator. And I love this quote from Maximus: "What we do in life echoes in eternity." I put this up here almost a little bit for some humor. Medicine right now loves the algorithm. And you're beginning to see these algorithms for end of life. You know, if this, then this. If this, then this. And there's nothing, you know, specifically wrong with algorithms, but they're limited. And it's important to recognize that many of these decisions just don't fit these algorithms. So end of life, it is a challenging time. It can be a stressful time for doctors and for families. It is at times strained by the family dynamics. And often when a loved one is either in a life-threatening situation or very sick, sometimes those strained family dynamics get worse. Not always, but oftentimes things start to kind of unravel. It's very easy at that point to really want a cookbook. Just give me something that I can know exactly what to do every time, particularly when situations are unpredictable or uncertain. And frankly, doctors often feel at times uncomfortable and sometimes unprepared to deal with these situations, because there's never just one situation that always shows themselves. They are as varied as the family situations that come to you. So Pulsed solves this problem to some degree. There's no question about that. This document was started in 1997 in Oregon. The Oregon Health System developed this, and its original name was Pulse, so Physicians Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. This is now a national movement. If you've not visited the website, you should. If you just Google Pulse, it's in almost all 50 states. I just looked at the website. There's probably only 3 states that this is not very active in right now. Missouri is in the development stage, which many of them are in. That's the most common. Oregon, it's done. It's in place. I think Washington, there may be one other state where it's in place. And what the desire is to have this as a document that is used by every institution, by every person, that this would be the end of life document that is present. Okay. It's a checkbox form. I'm going to show you an example. They're very pretty. Each state has a different color. They're really bright. They're very attractive. The website is very well put together. They are often put together by what's called facilitators. And there are facilitator training that people go through. You do not have to be a medical personnel. They will train you to do this. There is a script. One of the members of our committee, the Pulse Committee, actually went through the training because she really wanted to see what took place. There is a particular script that's gone through. And these documents may or may not need to be signed. That really depends upon the state. And when I say signed, meaning signed by the patient. And that's very state dependent. It has many names. It has various different acronyms depending upon the state. Okay. So this is what the first half of the page looks like. This is the one for Minnesota. The first section is basically a typical DNR order. Okay, do not resuscitate, resuscitate. Section B goes through treatment options. Okay, obviously if someone is still alive. The DNR order, if they're not breathing and they don't have a pulse, that becomes operative. But Section B goes through comfort measures only, limited additional interventions or aggressive treatment. And as you can see, the comfort measures only is much more detailed, very detailed out. And I'm sorry, it's probably hard for you to see. At that point, it says treatment with dignity, respect, and kept clean, warm, and dry. I mean, pretty much the basics of care. Limited additional interventions would include oral and IV medications, feeding, either by tube feeding, and then aggressive treatment, kind of, you know, intubation, advanced airway, these types of things. Section C is specifically antibiotics, and it's just no antibiotics except if needed in these, in, you know, one example, no intervention, no antibiotics, aggressive treatment. I'm not exactly sure what more the aggressive treatment is in regard to antibiotics. It's, you've either got a no or a yes, but then you have this other section with no aggressive treatment. Section D is the issue with food and nutrition. So no feeding tube is the first one. Defined period of feeding tube is the second one, and then long-term feeding tube. The following section is who this has been discussed with. And in Minnesota, there is a place for the patient's signature and also for either the physician. And this can be any physician, okay, or nurse practitioner. This isn't your family physician. This isn't the attending physician, okay? This is any physician or nurse practitioner can fill this, can sign this, okay? And the other thing I want to point out, this is supposed to be a physician order, okay? This isn't just a document. This is a physician's order, okay? So living wills, how does the church look at this? Okay, how has the church looked at advanced directives, living wills? I prefer the term advanced directives. Okay. They can help to identify patients' wishes, and they help us understand people's values, and that's very important as a doctor. They can assist you in decisions when the patient is no longer able to speak for themselves. And they can avoid unwanted or futile care. So what I'm trying to say in this is the church is not against advanced directives. She has supported advanced directives. They can be helpful. So how is a Catholic physician supposed to think about all of this? There is a certain mystery, both in life and in death. And one of the important pieces that the church certainly tries to focus on is that, you know, the health of the body is very important, but it's not an absolute. And without the health of the spirit, high technology focused strictly on preservation of the body really offers limited hope for the healing of the whole person, because we are body and soul. We are not just body. And death truly is the last enemy. If you look at 1 Corinthians 15:26, Paul speaks of this. Jesus conquered the last enemy, which is death. And death is the end of man's earthly pilgrimage. It is a time of grace and mercy which God offers him, and a time to work this out. And as Catholics, we believe that, you know, when that time of death occurs, that period of being able to choose your eternal destiny ends. Your whatever choices you have made in this life, it's fixed. And there is a final judgment. And so the church encourages us to prepare for death. It's a sacred time. And there is a great mystery to it. Dying in pain. Again, this is, I'm quoting from the Charter for Healthcare Workers, and I don't know if it's still in print by the Daughters of St. Paul, but if you don't have it, it's worth trying to get a hold of it. It's a beautiful document. And Christian charity itself requires of healthcare workers that we alleviate suffering. I mean, the church is very, what was our Lord's whole ministry, but a great part of it was healing. And that the terminally ill person has a right to die in total serenity with human and Christian dignity. That is a fundamental of our, how we approach end of life, how we approach healing of the patient. Nutrition, hydration, this is a huge area. The ERD represents the ethical and religious directives. These are the directives that if you are a Catholic physician or a Catholic facility, these are what we follow. If you espouse to be faithful to Catholic teaching, This is how it's done. You follow the ERDs. Food and water represent ordinary care. They are not medical care, even though by artificial means. We can't confuse the benefit of nourishing the body with the burden of treatment. Now, they can become extraordinary, and I'm going to talk a little bit about ordinary and extraordinary. When the patient cannot take in food anymore, when feeding tubes may be causing repeated infections, such as a cellulitis, or they may be causing a repeated pneumonia or discomfort. It's not that this is an absolute, but it is also important that it's not something that is off the table for all patients, simply because they've reached a certain age or maybe have a certain diagnosis, such as dementia. So your way, my way. Patient autonomy. What about patient autonomy? Because this is what gets brought up oftentimes. Currently in this country, this is the fundamental ethic that drives most ethics committees in most hospitals, certainly in the secular hospitals, and I would argue in many, many Catholic hospitals too. Autonomy is a good thing. What do people want? What is their value system? What is, you know, what is it that is important to them? The church is very much about protecting patient autonomy. But she doesn't say that it's an absolute, that it is the highest good, or that it's the only good that we're to follow. Pope Emeritus Benedict, in one of his writings, this is from Conscience and Truth, for him, and he's referring to modern man, conscience stands on the side of subjectivity, so what I want, and is the expression of the freedom of the subject. Authority, on the other hand, appears to him as the constraint on, threat to, and even the negation of freedom. And that is very often how many of our contemporaries look at conscience. It might be even how some of us look at conscience. The Holy Father goes on to say, much more than that, conscience signifies the perceptible and demanding presence of the voice of truth in the subject himself, meaning in me. It is the overcoming of mere subjectivity in the encounter of the inferiority of man with the truth. In other words, that conscience is not just a matter of what I want, but is to actually be in relationship to the truth about man. And again, as a Catholic, you know, when we look at this patient autonomy versus physician conscience, again, we go back to the ethical and religious directives. The free and informed judgment made by a competent adult patient concerning the use or withdrawal of life-sustaining procedures should always be respected. Always be respected. And normally complied with, unless it is contrary to Catholic moral teaching. So again, the church is very concerned with respecting what is a patient's values, what do they want. She can't always do what they want, though. And that's very important, either as a Catholic physician or as an institution. There's some things we won't and we just can't do. Again, we go back to something pretty basic. We go back to the fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill. Catechism of the Catholic Church beautifully defines this out. Okay. Intentional homicide, both directly or indirectly. Abortion. Human life must be respected and protected absolutely from the moment of conception. Okay. Euthanasia. Any act or omission which causes death by intention, even if the motive is the alleviation of suffering. And of course, suicide. We are stewards, not the owners of the life God has entrusted to us. It is not ours to dispose of. And I think that would also speak to all of us as physicians when we're working with our patients. So let me say a little bit about what ordinary and extraordinary mean. So again, I'm going back to the ethical and religious directives. Ordinary means is the obligation. We have an obligation to use ordinary means. Okay, so what does the church say ordinary means are? Those that are in the patient's judgment. It's a very important phrase. Offer reasonable benefit. Are not excessively burdensome to the patient and or the family, and they do not impose an excessive expense on the family or the community. Okay. So what makes something ordinary? The benefit, okay, the good that you're getting from whatever the treatment is, outweighs the burdens. It may give the patient time to heal. It can apply to a wide range of treatments, including respirators, including feeding tubes. Benefits and burdens can change. Okay, so what's ordinary can change and does change depending upon the clinical circumstances. And it always requires an honest and prayerful discernment, both from the physician, but also from the patient, from the family. Certainly if they come from a faith perspective. How does the church look at extraordinary? Okay, again, number 57 in the ethical and religious directives. Extraordinary means may be rejected. And again, it's those that are in the judgment of the patient. They entail excessive burden. They can be not offering a significant benefit based on the effort, the cost, the pain. They can be expensive. Extraordinary means may be morally good, but still not obligatory. Okay. It is important that we don't overstate either the burdens of treatment, and we do have to avoid at times an irrational belief in the benefits of certain medical interventions. Both those things are true. Okay. Again, number 59, when it becomes clear that life support is not providing benefit to the patient or that the burdens exceed the benefits to the patient, the decision can be made, not must be made, but can be made to withdraw it. The caveat here is unless it is contrary to Catholic moral teaching. Okay. So what I'm trying to paint with the ethical and religious directives is the wide scope the Catholic moral teaching does take on many of these things, and also how she frames these discussions. So again, benefits and burdens. The health benefit, the hope that it offers, the burdens, fundamentally to the patient, but may also be to the family. They entail effort with minimal hope for improvement. They could be excessive in their cost in relationship to the good that you're going to get. And I think we can all cite examples of that. And they can sometimes they can be just very psychologically distressing and or repugnant to the patient. Okay. The difficulty with this, with the discussion, is benefits and burdens change. It's impossible to provide a checklist of what will always be a benefit and what will always be a burden. Because what can be a burden one day may be a benefit the next, and vice versa. And the bottom line is, burdensome treatment doesn't necessarily equal burdensome life. And that's not always appreciated right now, I don't think, as much in our health system. At this particular juncture, I think a lot of times many physicians and many health providers look at burdensome treatment and just assume that, well, no one would want to do something like that. So there's kind of an assumption on foregoing treatment, not going down that road. And it's very important to know that doesn't necessarily reflect the patient's wishes. So What are the pitfalls of Pulsed? I showed you the document. It's brightly colored. In appearance, it looks like, gosh, this looks like it's kind of covering all the bases here. Ethics and Medics, which is the monthly, I believe it's monthly, it may be every couple months, paper that comes out from the National Catholic Bioethics Conference in January of 2012, did a very good analysis on Pulsed. And if you haven't seen this, I would recommend this. And there's a few things that they identified. One of the pitfalls that, and I can tell you this is being seen now, I mean, I have seen it with my own patients, is that when Pulsed was first started, the whole premise was this document is to be used at the end of life with a frail elder. Okay, so we're looking at someone that, you know, if you were to say, would you expect this patient to be alive in 5 years? No. Okay. Time to have the conversation, and Pulsed could be a very helpful document. Now it's being implemented, without a terminal illness, or in other words, without looking at someone and saying, no, I probably, you know, maybe they would live beyond 5 years. Pulsed could still be used. So it's being brought in much sooner. It's being looked at as a good document to have in place, kind of regardless. Okay, certainly end of life, certainly terminal diagnosis, but you know, it looks like it covers all the bases for other situations too. It may or may not require a patient's signature, and that is of real concern, certainly to me, and I would think to most people, because how do you know that your patient has really been actively in the conversation? If they haven't signed something, you have no way to know whether they've actually been involved in this conversation. It does not require the signature of the attending physician. So this document is supposed to travel with the patient, okay? And certainly before the era of electronic health records, that seemed pretty impossible. It's not impossible now. And if the vision happens, which is we have a seamless document that crosses all states, that any health system that you interact with at any point in this country can access your records from any other hospital, then this document could be present at any moment. It will travel with you because it'll be part of your end-of-life documents, basically. And it is an order. It's a physician's order. So that presumes that whoever interacts with it outside of a doctor, because we're notorious for we don't follow each other's orders very readily, but certainly a nurse, certainly an EMS worker, certainly the presumption is this is an order to be followed. Another pitfall is it is facilitated by non-physicians. Now, I wouldn't say that's always a problem, but it certainly could be a problem. And my own perspective on the script that is used is supposed to be used with patients when this document is filled out favors not going forward with certain treatments. I would argue that the way it's worded, the way people are trained to ask these questions is not necessarily as forthright about both sides of this issue, okay? And I think that's a problem. It's also, and this to me is just the fundamental issue, it is based on a simplistic checklist of yes or no, which is just simply, it's too easy. It doesn't take into consideration the complexity of medicine, the complexity of the dying process. So ethical concerns. It's asking the elder, and I'll give you a personal example. I have a patient in a nursing home in Lakefield, Minnesota, And on my desk one day showed up a Pulsed. And I was like, couldn't believe it. I hadn't seen Pulsed in the community yet. This was the first time I had seen it in the community. And I called up the nursing home and I said, where'd this document come from? Oh, well, we're requiring it of all our residents. Well, first of all, that's not legal. I mean, there's no one end of life document yet that you can just say, we require this of everybody. And basically, a staff member had filled this out. Well, I had discharged my patient to the nursing home, and I knew that there is no way she could have interacted in a meaningful way with these questions to fill this out. And so, again, it really brought home personally to me the problems with this, and I refused to sign it. And I just said, I will not sign this. I don't want this used on my patients. Forget it. I will provide you another end-of-life document if you want, but we're not using this. And at this point, you can still do that. You know, this is not law. But one of the biggest problems with Pulsed is it makes these decisions outside of any specific clinical situation. And one of the fundamental principles of, I'm going to say, Catholic ethics, it used to be just ethics in general, if you look 30 years ago, but now I would say of Catholic ethics, is you can't make a decision based in the future. You have to have the substance of what your decision, what are the points that you're trying to decide on. You can't just say, I never want A, B, or C, because you have no real life situation to describe, well, what is the situation that we're dealing with here? That to me is the biggest problem with Pulsed or any form that you're asked to fill out that just, it's just yes or no, always yes or no, no matter what. Again, it oversimplifies decisions that often have much more complexity in real life and need nuanced decision making. And anyone who has dealt with patients dying, anyone who has dealt with families knows this is not just a straightforward decision. You have a lot of different family members. They come from different perspectives. It is a lot of work to care for patients in hospice. To care for people who are dying, both for the nurses, for the doctors. And it has the potential to be used outside of terminal illness, outside of end of life, and it is being used. It is being used. It is being looked at as this is the document that we really should be coming, you know, behind. And again, it can be filled out, as I shared my example, by long-term care staff and then sent to a physician or a nurse practitioner for a signature. And that could be the medical director of the nursing home. May not be the primary care, may not be their doctor, okay? Now, in defense of Pulse, because I also want to try to be fair, you know, they will tell you this is supposed to be a fluid document. This is supposed to be something that changes over time, that as the clinical condition changes, you're going to change this document. My only response to that is, how good have we been with end-of-life care documents up to this point, being fluid with them, changing with them? What makes you think now that we just have this beautiful, brightly colored document, that all of a sudden these discussions are going to happen more readily or be more consistent with the patient's wishes? I think it's a pretty big jump. It is supposed to be a complement to prior advance directives, okay? They will tell you. We're not meaning this to replace, this is supposed to be in conjunction with. But the biggest problem is there is no place on this Pulse form that reflects those prior decisions, per se. Okay. Maybe there's going to be a way to link that, but at this point, the document itself seems pretty straightforward. Okay, there's nothing that would indicate a prior document or a prior conversation. So what should be recommended? This is a tough discussion because health systems are being pressured. Certainly in the state of Minnesota, we are really on the vanguard of kind of the rollout of Obamacare. Certainly the state of Minnesota has been very interested in population health and having a lot of things in place, a lot of systems in place. Some of that is very good. Some of that is really helpful. But it means that these decisions and discussions are happening very quickly. There is a real push in health systems to have something in place. And the difficulty is that there are a lot of very nice websites out there where you can put together your advanced directives. It looks really good. Again, it falls into this checkbox form. But it's much easier. It's much easier to do. And from the Catholic standpoint, when we are trying to weigh and look at these decisions, we need time. And these bodies that are looking at these decisions, or the federal government or the state government, is pushing. They want this done, want this out. My best advice to anyone is the development of a document that identifies a healthcare proxy. Okay, that is going to be the thing that will serve you the best. Even a document that per se spells out all of Catholic teaching, so to speak, okay, in a document, it's still a static form, okay? It still can't interact in the clinical situation that your loved one may find yourself in. The best, and it's great to have what are my thoughts, what are my wishes, what would I not want? But at the end of the day, what's most helpful from the doctor perspective, from the healthcare facility, is who are we going to talk to? We need to have a real life conversation that takes into account what's going on right now. And this person then can speak for you when you're unable to speak for yourself. And it enables conversations to take place in real time with, again, the current clinical situation at hand. Okay? And the argument will be, well, that didn't work before. Well, there's not an easy answer to these things. And again, I go back to the beginning of this presentation. What we all want is just an easy solution to the end of life. And my fear is that easy solution too often will be the decision to withdraw perhaps care that shouldn't be withdrawn, or to not move into care that perhaps should be done. So in summary, end of life is a privileged time to be with a patient, but it is truly also a challenging time. Care is often not, in fact, I said often just to be a little more broad, it's never black and white. It requires consideration of what is going on with the patient at that time and what's going on with the family. It necessitates an understanding of the church's teaching on the part of the Catholic physician and the ability to communicate that with love and gentleness. Okay. Most of all, it calls for a deepening of our own interior lives as doctors, as nurses, as healthcare providers, and really a recourse to daily prayer. And calling on the Holy Spirit, really fostering that relationship with the third person of the Blessed Trinity to give us the wisdom, to give us the insight in those very difficult situations. And the Lord will not abandon us. If you ask Him, He will always provide you with what is needed in those situations. I need to thank my fellow sisters, Sister Mariana Kuntz, who is the director for the Office of Health Services in Knoxville, Tennessee. I used some of her slides, so I'm very grateful to her, and I thank you all for your attention.
Okay, that was excellent. Thank you very much for that. I am truly humbled to present the next speaker. She is a wonderful wife and mother. Beyond that, you may have seen her on Fox News, CNN, MSNBC News a few years ago now for her involvement in the Terri Schiavo case. She was formerly with the Will to Live Project with the National Right to Life Committee. And she is going to give us some practical tips and tools for us to use and with our patients today, and hopefully some helpful points and things to consider on common ground on this issue, which can be very polarizing perhaps at times. People have strong feelings, but I welcome Dorothy Young. Thank you.
Thank you all for having me. I feel very out of practice. I've been a stay-at-home mom and haven't addressed anyone publicly on this topic, but I did have the great privilege of working at the National Right to Life Committee upon graduating law school. And I know what you guys are thinking. You're thinking, great, we really need a lawyer to come in here and muddy the waters. And I promise I will try not to do that. And I'm very humbled and honored to speak to so many medical providers. It's not my background. But I hopefully can give you a little bit of a perspective from a public policy standpoint. And I'm so impressed with the previous presentation. She just really hit the nail on the head on so many points, especially that last point about just the bottom line is you need to designate a healthcare proxy because these situations are just so fluid. And I know I'm probably speaking to the choir on a lot of these things, and a few points might be redundant, but hopefully helpful. And so just to give you a brief background, as soon as I had passed the bar exams, I was so excited. I was a pro-life, student organization leader in law school and in college, and I just really had a passion for right to life, but it was always for the abortion issue, the unborn. And I was excited to get to Washington, D.C., and use my newly honed advocacy skills on the abortion issue. And I did all of those things. And then I met the beautiful family of a woman named Terri Schiavo. And that changed everything. It didn't take long for me to realize firsthand why the pro-life movement has always been just as committed to protecting people with disabilities and older people who are vulnerable from assisted suicide and euthanasia as we have been in protecting the unborn. And it became very clear to me that God was, at that time, calling me to use my advocacy skills and talents in on the euthanasia and assisted suicide issue. Oftentimes, the mainstream media likes to relegate and dismiss the pro-life position as that of the religious extremists. And I would clarify at the outset that the organization I worked with was non-sectarian and single issue, just on right to life. We didn't take position on the sanctity of the family or anything other than right to life, conception to natural death. And we would often work alongside the Catholic Church, sharing obviously mutual goals, but we were not affiliated with the church in any way. And I personally found this to be of great benefit in debating the issue in the mainstream media, and we came at it from more of a human rights perspective. And it was a real strength to reach out to a more, I think, diverse group of people, especially in debating the other side on it. And most of us are familiar with what is generally referred to as a living will. I know that the previous presenter talked about that. But these are legal documents where we can express our wishes about the provision or withholding of medical treatment, food, or fluids in the event we are unable to speak for ourselves. Tonight, I want to give a short legal primer on these documents and call your attention to a uniquely pro-life document that is the will to live, and familiarize you with a concept called feudal care theory. Who all here is familiar with feudal care theory? So I don't know kind of what your expertise is, okay. And I want to touch briefly on some critical points that help to clarify things when it comes to medical ethics from a Catholic perspective. So I hope to offer you a compassionate vision, and I know it's, like she said, these are not easy situations. I'm not here to say that at all. I'm here to say they're very difficult, and we do have, thankfully, some great principles to guide us. But also, don't forget, I'm not talking to you just about the patients that you're going to be caring for, because all of us are going to be one day unable to speak for ourselves, every single one of us. And so we need to be anticipating this for ourselves. I personally have had a number of situations in my own life where I've just been shocked to see how they were handled when there was no advance planning at all. But to begin, and I don't have a PowerPoint, my presentation is going to be quite brief. I wanted to highlight the difference between traditional medical and ethical approaches to end-of-life treatment decisions versus the increasingly pervasive feudal care theory. And this is utilized today by most ethics committees and providers. And if you read journal articles, it's commonly referred to. I also like to talk about the differences between a living will document, which is a more traditional document, and what I propose, the will to live document. So why is it important to be familiar with feudal care theory, and why has it impacted end-of-life decisions, or how? Well, traditionally, when a patient was faced with a decision regarding a particular life-saving treatment, the primary question was a medical one. It was based on physiological realities. Will it have a reasonable likelihood of success for achieving the end for which it's intended? In other words, will it work? Will the feeding tube serve to nourish and hydrate this particular patient? Will the antibiotic treat the infection? Oftentimes, the provider would explain the medical probability of success to the patient and his family, as well as, of course, any risks or benefits to the patient and burdens. The family weighs the likelihood of success of the treatment against those risks, burdens, and benefits, and they make a decision about whether to proceed. Again, the question was primarily a medical question. In contrast, we did not see this kind of medical analysis in the case of Terry Schiavo, did we? Remember, she was a young woman with a severe brain injury. She was not terminally ill. She was not dying. Because of her brain injury, she could not eat or drink, and she relied upon a feeding tube to survive. And various professionals disagreed on her level of awareness, although it was very clear she was not in a coma. So she had never expressed her wishes in writing, and the issue there, of course, was what would she have wanted, and if she could have, you know, forecasted the situation, would she want this feeding tube? So using the traditional approach, we would have asked, would the feeding tube serve to nourish and hydrate this patient? And the answer would have been easy there. Yes, it certainly does. And it had for many, many years. And I don't know if you remember, but throughout the case, different judges would decide different things, and the feeding tube would come out. And then 6 days later, right before she would die, they'd appeal and it would go back in. And she went back and forth this way for, I don't know, half a dozen times. When I encountered her family, it was really there at their time of just complete desperation, where they had exhausted all possible legal remedies in Florida, both judicial and legislative, and were obviously seeking federal legislation. So now we have medical and legal professionals and all kinds of ethicists and lawyers discussing publicly whether her quality of life is worth living. It was no longer a medical question. It was now very much a subjective quality of life assessment being imposed upon her from others. But underneath all the myriad court cases and media interviews and debates, the bottom line was basically one philosophy versus another. Should we be utilizing subjective quality of life considerations in deciding who should live and who should die? Or are these decisions medical ones to be made by the patient herself. And so to highlight this point of view about how quality of life assessments are very dangerous and confusing, one of the things that I found most fascinating in my work on that case was this unlikely alliance that we made with the disability rights groups. One group in particular, Not Dead Yet, was just really in tune with what was really at stake. They are not your typical pro-life ally on the abortion issue at all. But these people are very smart, and they knew who was being targeted. They knew that it was not people who were dying or people who are terminally ill. It's people who have severe and profound disabilities. Again, she just needed a feeding tube. She's neither terminally ill nor dying. And her family very much loved her and wanted to continue spending time and caring for her. And they found that to be immensely satisfying. So there's this powerful movement against them which believed that her quality of life was not worth living. And the people with disabilities, they could see exactly what was going on here. And they knew that that the right to die would soon become a duty to die for them. So the provision of the feeding tube for Terry was tragically ultimately considered futile, not because it was no longer working. It was working quite well. It was considered futile and no longer appropriate because many people thought her quality of life was futile, meaning it's not worth sustaining. So that's kind of a perfect snapshot of how feudal care theory has changed the landscape of medical decision making. The question of whether a treatment is futile is, again, no longer a mere medical weighing of the risks and benefits. It really involves subjective quality of life assessments. That's the reality that we're in, sadly. According to Dr. Lachlan Farrow, director of ethics programs at Boston's Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, about 15 years ago, at least 80% of the cases were right to die kinds of cases. But today, it's more like 80% of the cases are cases in the other direction, where we have the family members pushing for continued or more aggressive treatment, and doctors and nurses who think it's wrong. Many hospitals now have written feudal care policies. Now, they're not always public, and sometimes it's very difficult to get your hands on them. They don't want to share what their policy is, but they oftentimes do have policies, even Catholic hospitals. And in these policies, they list criteria to justify denial of treatment. Even, this is the critical point, even over the expressed will of the family representative or patient. A study of policies at 26 California hospitals, for example, found that all but two of them specifically define circumstances in which life-preserving treatments should be denied, even when requested by the patient or the representative. Commonly, they would deny treatment to patients with severe, irreversible dementia, and this would presumably include people with Alzheimer's disease. The authors of the study urged that healthcare providers refuse to provide non-beneficial treatment and then defend their decisions as consistent with medical standards. The American Thoracic Society has issued an official statement on withholding and withdrawing life-sustaining therapy, stating, "Life support can be limited without the consent of the patient or surrogate when the intervention is judged to be futile." The paper defined futile as an intervention that would be highly unlikely to result in a meaningful survival for the patient. And I emphasize the subjective word meaningful. And it brings to mind really the dangers of the pulsed form, I think. It's also, of course, critical to remember that most states have now defined artificially, and judicial cases have now defined artificially provided nutrition and hydration as medical treatment. It's no longer considered ordinary care. But as John Paul II taught unequivocally, patients labeled as PVS or persistent vegetative state are still always entitled to food and water, even when it must be supplied through a feeding tube. He said, "It's unjust to refuse or initiate or continue basic care based on a subjective quality of life assessment or on a claim that it's too expensive. It's also unjust to discontinue it because of a decreased hope of recovery." So it was very explicit what he said. Nutrition and hydration is a natural means of preserving life and should be considered in principle, ordinary and proportionate, and as such, morally obligatory. So what does Missouri law say? Well, in Missouri, a healthcare facility can refuse to provide life-preserving measures pursuant to its sincerely held moral convictions, but only if they have not received a copy of your durable power of attorney for healthcare prior to getting treatment. So I think especially in Missouri, and this language is actually very unique, we really need to be encouraging both for ourselves and our patients to have something in writing. That's very protective, because otherwise the law clearly states if that provider or hospital finds this patient or their situation to be futile, it doesn't matter what you have, what you've said orally. You've got to have it in writing before the treatment begins. So let me contrast the living will versus the document that I brought. There should be a copy versus the will to live. The living will is an advance directive. It's probably what most of you are familiar with. It starts really with the presumption for withholding treatment, food, or fluids. The statutes which allowed for many of these documents, again, were written decades ago. And in most codes, if you look at any state statute on this topic, there's usually a whole section, and they usually have a state mandated, or it's a state form, it's not mandated, but you can use it. And many lawyers just pull the language directly out of these statutes because they, you know, they want to make sure that it's legitimate. But again, it's from many, many years ago, many decades ago, when we were in a completely different landscape, and they are written from the presumption of withholding and withdrawal, because again, those disputes were looked very differently. The will to live, and the law clearly allows for you to choose whatever document you want. There are a few states that will say you have to use this form, but you can add your own language to it, and we've managed to do that. But in Missouri, you can use whatever form you like, as long as it's notarized and signed. The will to live, on the other hand, it's a durable power of attorney, primarily. It allows you to name someone in the event you cannot speak for yourself, which, again, is so critical because these situations change constantly, and you can't really predict, you could never create a form to predict all the situations. But it does specifically, I think, in a very unique way, allow you to state your values on food and water. It doesn't say something like, oh, I'm Catholic, I want to be in line with the church. That's a terrible thing to say for a legal document. You do not want some judge trying to interpret that. That would be a disaster. So you want to say, food and water are ordinary care, not medical treatment. I always want food and water unless it's, you know, the body is physically unable to assimilate it. You want to say it that specifically. So in Missouri, obviously, your representative is called an attorney in fact. In other states, it's called an agent, or representative. But it's the will to live starts with the presumption that you do want treatment. A lot of people would say, well, I don't know about this form because it's almost too, like, you know, like she said, we're not required to accept every treatment available. I would just say, based on my experience and the 3 to 5 phone calls per week that I used to get at Right to Life from everyday families just like ours, asking for help in situations where they wanted treatment and it was being denied, I don't think you are going to be in danger of that. I think you're in a lot more danger of asking for all measures and getting a few if you're lucky. But you can write in this form whatever you want. There is a lot of freedom there, I think. There's a portion that allows you to talk about when you're terminally ill, when you only have three months to live. A whole portion where you can write out whatever you feel is important. It also allows you to select an alternative agent, which I think is also important. Why is it really protective? I think a lot of times, at least in my experience at Right to Life, you had family members who were up against doctors and ethics committees. These family members were already in extreme emotional distress, and they were having to advocate on behalf of their loved one who could no longer speak in this already a very difficult situation to an ethics committee. And they're up against a lot of pressure, and it is really helpful if they just have a document, because those individuals who are highly educated and persuasive and they hold all the power, they can very easily persuade these family members, she would never want to live like this. She never would have wanted this. She's, look at her. You know, and they are very persuasive. And so these people would call us and say, what am I supposed to do? I just think it relieves the agony of the decision-making to at least, it kind of gives them a leg to stand on to say, hey, this is not me. This is what this person really wanted. This was their priority. I think that receiving life-saving treatment, food and fluids, is very difficult where a patient suffers from severe dementia. Obviously, there are a lot of other situations where the provider thinks the quality of life is too poor. And honestly, there are no guarantees that your wishes are going to be followed. I wish I could say that there were, but in all but 12 states, the law does allow for the provider to ultimately decide. I think one of the things that has resonated with me the most about our current Pope, Pope Francis, is that we live in a throwaway culture. And I just think that's so true, even despite the nation's pro-choice public policies. I think, you know, everyone here tonight would recognize the beauty of a newborn child. They are completely dependent. They are vulnerable. They're desperate for our care. And yet it's that very aspect of their vulnerability that beckons us to care for them and fight for them. And we see their beauty, not for who they're going to be, but just for who they are. We see that so clearly. And yet when we think about people with profound disabilities or severe dementia who no longer have control of basic bodily functions, it's so much more difficult. And I think the church is really a gift to us because she, you know, challenges us that even in those most fragile states, we really are the most beautiful. And I think that's really special. So I think as Catholic providers, we're called to reject that subjective utilitarian quality of life assessment that is really more pervasive now, and instead provide uniquely compassionate care that we're all deserving of as sons and daughters of God.